course.
Yes, well, if you were able to come down to Monterey and catch us over there at Dizzy's Den, this last year you were able to see this wonderful artist, Miss Maria Schneider. Hey, Maria.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very good.
Well, you know, generally you are residing in the city of New York, but now I guess the snow and Prince, those two words would let us all know that you happen to be in Minneapolis today.
Yep, freezing my butt off here. It's really been cold. I've been here for about 6 days. I'm going to be here for another four. And I mean, I'm kind of adjusting to the cold. So there was a period where after I left and I came back, I couldn't take it. But, you know, I don't know, I'm getting more resilient again.
Well, you're born and raised there, so now I'm wondering, is global warming warming it up for you a little bit, or is it still pretty cold?
No, it gets cold, but it's nothing like, it's mainly the precipitation. They don't get the amounts of snow that we used to get when I was a kid. You know, the snow would blow right up over the house, and you don't see drifts of snow down here like that anymore. So I don't know. Yeah, it's changed a lot.
You know, I just caught my first clue when you said amounts. I heard that.
Amounts. You know.
Well, you know, I would want to say congratulations to you. You know, you're a Grammy Award winner now for the best instrumental composition for your Cerulean Skies piece. I mean, that's beautiful. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really, you know, it's so nice if you get recognition for your music. You know, we just making music, being part of such a great community, which you know well through all the interviews you do, how many amazing people are in this, you know, genre of music. And so if on top of it you get something like that, it's fantastic.
Well, I was going to say, you know, not that we do this music to win awards, but certainly, you know, there's a lot of love and creativity in our motivation. But it's very wonderful to be recognized for your talents, and, you know, you're to be very commended for that.
Thank you.
So, I mean, I'm sure that all are interested in the concept to completion of a Grammy-winning composition. I mean, where and in what part of the world did you have the idea for Cerulean Skies, and how did that come into existence?
Well, this piece, as many of my pieces are, was a commission. And it was a very unique commission. It came from Peter Sellers, the opera producer, Peter Sellers. And he's the one that's alive, not the other one. And he was putting on the big Mozart festival in Vienna. And it was a huge, huge event. And he decided he wanted a festival that had not one note of Mozart. And that if he took the idea of really, first of all, Mozart was a very, very liberal man. And so it was called the New Crowned Hope Festival because he belonged to the Last Masons group in Europe, and it was called the New Crowned Hope. So his idea was the best way to honor Mozart is by commissioning new works by today's composers, today's filmmakers, opera, plays, artists, even chefs. It was just, Vienna was just all about creativity of new things. And he had a lot of people coming from, you know, war-torn countries because he really wanted people to express the problems of the world today. And so, you know, I was the jazz person.
Yeah.
And my music doesn't tend to be political. And I also don't tend to pick a subject and then write about it. The way that I work is I sit down and I start writing, and it's sort of like a Ouija board. Music starts coming up, and then usually after a period of time, sometimes music just comes up as sound, and it's nothing more than just sound that I like. But more often than not, it attaches itself to some kind of memory. I'll be writing, and all of a sudden I'll realize that at the same time I'm remembering something that happened when I was a child or some experience, and all of a sudden I realized that's what I'm writing about. It's like the music is pulling out this experience and recreating the experience in sound. So when I started this piece, I was birding in Central Park. It was May, I'm a pretty avid birder in May because the migration coming through New York is just insanely spectacular. And so every morning I was out there, you know, at 6:30 in the morning with my birding friends and, you know, spotting 60 species of different, you know, warblers and vireos and everything. And I would come home, and all of a sudden this piece started coming out, and I realized it was a piece that really kind of tracked the migration of the birds, the opening up of a forest in South America, the joy, then the instinctual urge to migrate, and then going up into the sky and being in the mind's eye of one little warbler fluttering by the lights of the, you know, the stars and the moon, and then arriving in Central Park, and then that's where the joy, all hell breaks loose, and it's just, you know, pure joy, where I get to appreciate these creatures. So it was that, and so it was a bit of an environmental piece, I guess. That's as political as I got.
Well, you know how it's really interesting how sounds, as you say, can be political just by the way you stress the dynamic on them, you know.
And well, that's what Peter would say, you know, that just by the nature of it being something that's coming from the present, it is speaking of now, and that's an important thing.
Well, did you ever see a Baltimore Oriole out there at 6 o'clock in the morning?
Oh, yes, many. You hear the, oh, I'm in Minnesota, the O comes out big time. You know, oh, yes, there's a lot of Baltimore Orioles and scarlet tanagers, and I mean, it's stunning. I brought this year, do you know a drummer named Kendrick Scott?
Yes, absolutely.
One wonderful drummer, and he had played with me. He said, I want to come birding with you. So one morning he got up really early, and I brought him out birding, and he just flipped out. He saw a scarlet tanager, and his eyes were just huge. Kate McGarry, I brought her out birding. Do you know Kate McGarry?
Yes.
Voice. And she just really got into it. It's amazing. You see these little creatures, and they've flown all the way up from Peru, and they're still heading up to Canada or Alaska, and you just have to have some respect, you know. It's amazing.
All right, that's it. Everybody, 6 o'clock, New York City in May. We're hanging out with Maria to check out.
Oh, absolutely. I'll lead a little bird group. It'd be fun.
A bird jazz group.
Yeah.
You're listening to Maria Schneider, right, excuse me, you're listening to Grammy Award winner Maria Schneider, right here on the show Live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM, KRML, Jazz and Blues Radio, on the For Locals Only show with Mr. Gary Hamada. You know, your compositions, your sound is so sparkling clean. I mean, each and every note is delivered with such preciseness. I mean, what measures the degree of difficulty when performing and recording your music?
It's difficult. It's difficult because a lot of my orchestration is doubling maybe two people on a note. I'll combine one trombone with a clarinet, maybe the trombone and a mute. So people are constantly playing with somebody else, and they have to be perfectly in tune. And the thing I'm trying to do is really make the big band not sound like a big band. So I'm trying to mix all these colors in unique ways that people aren't used to hearing. So you hear the sound and you say, wow, is that a French horn? Wait, there's no French horn on this. You know, so and to play that is really hard. And then in the studio, I think even harder than the perfection is to get the level of spontaneity and communication between the rhythm section and the soloist and with the band, and between the bass and the drums, when you've got everybody set up in different booths and, you know, with headphones, and it really took us a day for everybody to forget the physical space and just get into the psychic space. And I, for instance, Ingrid was playing trumpet, and I just said, forget the fact that you're across the room and you can't see Clarence. Listen in your headphones. Imagine he's right behind you, just like he is at the Jazz Standard. And so everybody had to get into that mentality,
right,
for us to sound like they sound live. And honestly, a studio performance is never going to have the spark that a live performance has, because an audience is so important.
Oh, they provide such energy.
Yeah, I remember when I was in college, we had some, I don't know if it was ethnomusicology, or we had some professor, and he would talk about the importance of the audience and the communication. And I remember at the time, I just thought, oh, you know, this is just, you know, I couldn't relate to it. But now that I have my own band and we perform in a lot of different halls and clubs, I have noticed, for instance, if you play in a concert hall and the lights are such that on stage it just looks pitch black and you can't see anybody's face, you know, if the lights kind of blind you out that way.
Yeah.
And the band doesn't play with nearly the excitement than if they can literally see the faces in the audience. It's just night and day, the difference. And or the proximity. Some concert halls have the audience set way back from the stage. That's never good.
Yeah.
For the performance. It's amazing.
Well, you know, I'm really glad that we're talking about it, because one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was this. Just off the top of your head, what four instruments playing what notes in what key make the sweetest harmonic sound? Just off the top of your head.
Oh, geez. Oh, my gosh. Well, that's just impossible. That's the hardest question anybody's ever asked me. Sweetest sound. I think the sweetest sound there is just the sound of a voice. Because you have the breath and the air and the expression, and you have the words. And I think one of the things that I think affected this last record that I did more than anything is that I've been listening to singers more. Even just pop, you know, I was listening a lot to Luciana, and I don't even know who. I was just listening more to songs, and I think it affected me to write for the instruments in a way that feels more like vocal melody than instrumental melody. And I think that was a good switch, or some kind of switch anyway for me.
Well, it seems like, you know, really all music and all instruments are, you know, the best emulation of the voice is kind of what we try to perfect when we're playing the instruments, just because that's the first original natural sound, I would imagine.
Yeah, and the players that I love the most are the ones that with one note can make that note be almost a whole harmonic structure. The note becomes almost like a line. Bob Brookmeyer is like that. You know how he just plays one note on the trombone and it's got a little bend in it or a little push of air through it, and it just surrounds you. And the other person that I always think of that way is Toots Thielemans. You know, I mean, Toots is just the harmonica. You know, what he does with one tone, it can just, it's like he's weeping. It's so beautiful.
I mean, you've had the pleasure of playing with so many musicians, and I mean, and playing with a group of as many musicians as you try to play with and coordinating it all and hearing all of their different sounds. Do you write just like Duke individually for each one of those players?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes people will say to me, they'll say, do you do it like Duke? You know, and when I say, oh, yeah, I don't mean, oh, yeah, I'm like Duke. But I think what I mean is, just that if you're with the same musicians, and I think that's one of the things that's really unique about my group, is most of us, there's been a few switches and changes and additions over the years, but the core of the group has been the same people. And if you're with those people for that many years, you can't help but write for them.
Yeah.
It's like when you know somebody for years and you have a certain way of talking with them, or you might have a conversation with one person and a certain kind of language that you use with a friend would not be the same kind of language you would use with somebody else. You know, you have this relationship to them and their sound and their way or whatever, and I can't help that. That's just part of it. And the bigger thing I would say that I don't often get the chance to talk about, and I think it's really important, is more even than me writing to them, I write what I write because of them. And what I think, what I would say is that there is no way that I would be writing the music I write if it weren't for these players. I'd be writing something else, but it wouldn't be this, because over the years, they've each showed me what's possible. I write music for them, but they bring something of themselves to the music, and then all of a sudden I say, oh, wow, I can do this. Or the brass section starts to show me a way that something can be phrased that makes me realize a whole another way of writing is possible. And that so my music has evolved as a result of them. So, you know, I have to really be grateful. They are a huge part of my creative voice. And so, you know, I'm really indebted to that.
That's beautiful. You are listening to the wonderful Maria Schneider right here on the show, live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM, KRML, Jazz and Blues Radio, on the For Locals Only show with Mr. Gary Hamada. Now, this isn't improvised music. I mean, everything seems to have an order and a place to achieve a common goal, correct?
There's aspects that are improvised in the music, and then there's aspects that aren't. For instance, the rhythm section has a lot of freedom. I mean, sometimes it's very written out, but there are other sections where they're really molding it and changing it. And even the written ensemble, there are nights where a section where we usually play it really strong and active, Clarence Pan will play really soft, and then we all collectively change the way we play it. It just changes the whole direction of the piece, and everybody comes in really soft, even though it's written in the part to play loud or something.
I mean, that's great when one musician can kind of direct a change in the music, and everybody's like, oh, okay, well, let's do that, you know?
Have you ever seen starlings fly, you know, when they flock? I don't know, it happens in the one season, I think in the fall or something, where they just, one turns, it's like a school of fish, and that everybody turns just on a dime.
Yes.
The band is like that now, that one person turns and everybody grabs it. They are so fast, or the soloist does something, and I always say to the rhythm section, if they get into some groove behind a solo, and it's something different than we're used to doing, I always say to Clarence and the bass and everything, to Jay Anderson, and I say to those guys, whatever you get into, keep it going. When the band comes in with whatever is written, don't switch up to accommodate the written music. Let the written music have to accommodate what you're doing, because the most important part is the freedom.
Absolutely.
And the written music will sound free when it's got that freedom underneath it. The big mistake with big band music is on the solos, everybody's blowing, and then when it's written, everybody's just playing what's written.
I agree. You know, you don't play the notes, you let the notes play you.
Absolutely. So the music has to breathe, and I take really great care to try to make the solo section seamless into the written section, so you almost don't know where the freedom begins and ends, that the soloist is kind of guided, and that the soloists are usually playing over different material, so they each have their own space and contribution to the piece. So it's not like a theme in variations where, you know, Donnie McCaslin blows, and now a trumpet's going to blow, and let's see if he can outdo what Donnie just did, and now somebody else is going to blow. You know, that I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in that the whole collection of my music, the rhythm section, the ensemble and the soloist, that we all make one story together. And then at the end, we create this unified thing, and everybody just says, wow, look at what we did. It's not, look at what I played over that piece. You know,
right.
Of course, there's some of that. You know, somebody plays a great solo, and everybody in the band just drops their jaw and, you know, pats them on the back or something, because it's astounding. But so that there is that virtuosic part, you know, but there has to be the big picture, you know, the story in the music.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think most music has a story to tell, but when I listen to your compositions, I feel like a ballerina is dancing and seamlessly sewing a tapestry of scenes and emotions together, you know.
You know, it's weird. Can I just say something about the analogies you just picked?
Yes.
Are you aware that I dance when I write?
No.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because when you're sitting at a piano or at a desk, you lose sense of time. You know, you spend maybe a whole day working on one bar that passes by in 5 seconds. And you lose the sensibility of what this feels like. You know, I always say that music is art that exists in time. So in order for your piece to be heard, you have to draw the listener in at the beginning of the piece and carry their attention, just like you do in a movie or anything, draw them through the whole story to the end. And the only way that I can get myself that involved, to that committed, is to do it physically with my body. So I'll write something, and then I'll put on some headphones and listen to it, you know, playing the piano, and I just start dancing. And then my body will say, ooh, I want this section to go longer because I want to do this and that, or this should be shorter, or it needs to get really soft here. So I look like a nut. You know, in New York, I've got windows looking at the back of my place, and I'm dancing around, you know, half the time, not quite as dressed as I should be. It must be, with YouTube, one of these days, I'm going to be really sorry that it exists. But, and then the other thing, the tapestry thing, is I really picture, too, the music almost like textures and tapestries and curtains of different see-throughness, opacity, or whatever, you know.
Right.
And I see the music visually like that, too. So it's wonderful. You know, it's so hard to start something, and when it's not coming and it feels bad, there's nothing that feels worse. You just want to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, you know. But when it flows and you get into the whole vibe of writing a piece and you dive into that space and you're so involved, every corpuscle is involved in creating, you know, a sound experience, it's just the greatest. It's so much fun.
You know, I love that you dance to bring your music to life, and it shows. I mean, we hear it when we're listening to it, so that's why I came up with the analogies, because I get it. You know, and I was also asking, you know, when you're composing, can you visually conceive the texture on the paper? Can you look at it and see the dance?
Say that again. Say that.
You know, when you're composing and you have all of your notes on the page and you're looking at it, when you're looking at a piece of music, can you visually conceive the texture on paper just by looking at the notes?
No. It's more that you have to get into the sound and you have to imagine this multidimensionality of it. It's almost as if music is a two-dimensional page. It's these notes, but each of those notes have vibration, and vibration that I think goes beyond it's four-dimensional. Who knows, maybe it's fifth-dimensional, and it's spaces. I don't know what we're dealing with in music, you know, all the levels of vibration are. And so you have to try to imagine how that music, how those instruments are going to vibrate and what kind of sound they're going to create and how that's going to hit somebody's ear and heart and make them feel and what's going to draw them along. It's such an amazing thing when you think, you know, I sit down and I come up with the bird piece, and I'm like, oh, I want to put this feeling into this music. So I try to come up with these notes. I codify it in little black dots on a white piece of paper with lines on it, and then I hand it to the musicians, and they each have a piece of pipe or a piece of wood with a string, and they make vibration by changing the length of the pipe or vibrating a reed or, you know, changing the length of a string. And then collectively they do that, and then they start to internalize the big picture and the feeling of the music, and then they can bring that to it. Then they put all that into the air. It creates vibration. And then the listener has this eardrum that picks up that vibration and catches the original feeling that was in my heart when I started writing it. That's quite a mystical path there, right?
That's an incredible process, and it must feel so good to hear it come back.
It feels good if what comes back has the feeling that you wanted to put into the piece.
Right,
It's incredibly frustrating if it's not successful, and you say, and the hardest is when you hear it for the first time, when the musicians don't yet know what it is. They're just blowing air through their pipe and trying to make the right sound, but they don't quite get it. And you're hearing it. You say, oh, this doesn't have the feeling that I wanted, you know, and yeah. I immediately think I've forgotten how to write. And then usually they start to get it. I usually make a few fixes, and all of a sudden, you know, the piece rises above. Wayne Shorter said to me once, he said, Miles Davis used to love music that didn't sound like music. And I know just what he means. Mm. It's music that conveys something so much beyond music.
Right.
That's the thing that makes us all drawn to music and love music so much. It's not for the music. It's for what?
The heartstrings. The strings of the right. Heart.
Or where that music is taking us to some common place where we all connect. You know, that to me is the spiritual part of it, or something, or the mystical part of it.
Man, and creating jazz music is so beautiful too.
You know, let me just tell you something that happened to me. I wrote to you know, I do this thing through my website, through Artishare, where I sell through my own site, and so I have quite a list of people, and I sent out a holiday letter because I was just in Prague, and when I was in Prague, I met all these old musicians who had lived under communism for so long, and they would listen. They discovered Willis Conover on The Voice of America, and they one night we went out, and they were telling me, one told me how the first night he discovered it, it was at 9 o'clock at night, and he realized it was on every night, and he would sit there. And they couldn't get it on the radio. They had to get it on the shortwave radio because this wasn't allowed, you know, in communist Czechoslovakia or the Eastern Bloc countries. And they told me it just saved them. And they would look at the American embassy and see that American flag, and it was such, you know, a vision of hope. And just within a week of that, Scott Robinson in my band told me about a man he and Lee Konitz met in Japan, who during World War II said that he had an old Victrola he kept in his basement, and he would listen to Louis Armstrong, and he had to do it in private. No, of course, nobody could know he was listening to American jazz in the middle of World War II.
Wow.
And so he did that. And what I realized is how jazz brought the world together and tore down the walls of, you know, communism and these crazy ideologies, that jazz was the thing that connected us to each other, and rang of the, you know, the message of freedom and hope and joy, and it was really profound. On this trip, I realized how important art is, you know, not just jazz, music and art and everything. It's the human spirit.
Mm-hmm. That's how we vibrate it, you know. It's creativity, and it's so beautiful to take something that's non-existent, put it on this earth, and people all over the globe get it.
Yeah, it's this universal thing that people get. That, you know, your countries can be bombing each other or hating each other. Oh, this was the other thing. A week before I went to Prague, I was playing the jazz standard. And years ago for the Monterey Jazz Festival, my first commission I did for them was something called Scenes from Childhood. And the first movement was called Bomb Shelter Beast, and because my father built a bomb shelter during the Cold War. And the door of it was by my bed. And the piece has a theremin that Scott Robinson plays, and it sounds just like an air raid siren. And it's just utterly terrifying. So we played it at my gig with the theremin and everything, and it's just very bombastic. And these four Russian men come up with a translator, and two of them were government officials. One was a composer, and I forget what the fourth one was. And this woman says, I'm here with four men from Russia, and they just want me to tell you that their favorite piece was the Cold War piece. And I thought, oh my God. In my lifetime, I went from, you know, my father building a bomb shelter to me writing a piece about it that has fear, but it also has an element of humor. And these men from the government from Russia sit down and tell me they just adored the Cold War piece. Isn't that out?
360 degrees. You're listening to Maria Schneider right here on the show live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM KRML Jazz and Blues Radio on the For Locals Only show with Mr. Gary Hamada. Gary, how much time do we have left?
Just about out of time. I'm sorry to hear that because it's so much passion behind Maria's voice and what she's talking about. I'm certainly I'm one of the big fans, so I can listen to this all night.
Thank you. When we didn't hear from you, I was just going to say I think Gary fell asleep.
No, and by the and by the looks of the number of people that are listening on the internet, it seems like they're also being involved in your conversation. So it is certainly a good interview.
Well, Maria, thank you so much for coming on live with the Jazz Cat, and congratulations once again to being a 2009 Grammy winner. Your album is called Sky Blue. It's out there. Please pick it up. And the tune that won the Grammy, Cerulean Skies. Beautiful. Miss Maria Schneider. Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
Absolutely.